Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 61. Mostly sunny tomorrow, warmer, a high of 85. For Sunday, a slight chance of some showers and storms in the morning. Otherwise, it'll be a partly sunny day with a high around 86. Right now, 65. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I know there are many Packers fans out there, and I have a feeling you may be especially interested in the conversation that is about to unfold. A conversation with a really fine sports writer by the name of Ian O'Connor. I had the pleasure of speaking with Ian O'Connor over a decade ago about his wonderful book, Arnie and Jack, Palmer Nicklaus and Golf's Greatest Rivalry. He has written a number of other really compelling sports-related biographies. I have a feeling none of them may be quite as interesting as his latest book just out, which is called Out of the Darkness, The Mystery of Aaron Rodgers. And of course, I don't think anybody listening to this program needs to know who Aaron Rodgers is. And you probably already have at least an inkling of what a fascinating figure and often divisive figure Aaron Rodgers has been and continues to be. And I am quite impressed with the meticulous way with which Ian O'Connor has explored this really quite fascinating story. In addition to the books that Ian O'Connor has already written, we should say that he has been a sports columnist for ESPN.com, the New York Post, the New York Daily News, USA Today, and the winner of a number of different writing competitions. This latest book, once again, Out of the Darkness, The Mystery of Aaron Rodgers, published by Mariner Books. And Ian O'Connor, we welcome you to the morning show.
My pleasure, Greg. Thanks so much for having me on.
Tell us a little bit, although maybe it's too obvious a question. Nevertheless, I'm curious to know what in particular drew you to the figure of Aaron Rodgers, and whatever that was that drew you. Were you also worried about just what a challenge it would be to get at the heart of this mysterious figure?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that was a concern, and it's certainly a great challenge that I knew I was taking on. But to backtrack just a little bit, I was always fascinated by the Packers from a distance. I grew up in northern New Jersey, and of course in the Northeast there are just so many Packers fans, and in large part because of Vince Lombardi growing up in that area, coaching in that area. Vince Lombardi actually coached at my high school. The only head coaching job Vince Lombardi ever had before he became head coach of the Packers was St. Cecilia High School in Englewood, New Jersey, where I ultimately played on the team. And so that legacy of Lombardi always meant so much to me. He lived 8 houses away from where I grew up.
Wow.
My childhood home. Yeah. And so I was always a big Lombardi guy, and I always felt like I had a Packers book in me. And even though Aaron Rodgers, of course, now is employed by the New York Jets, he's going to be remembered as a Packer, let's face it. So this was my Packers book, and ultimately I was scheduled to do a biography of LeBron James. Another, unbeknownst to me, another book on LeBron James was in the works. And at the same time, Aaron Rodgers was traded into my backyard in New York. And so I felt this would be a good time to make a trade here, LeBron for Aaron. And I've always been, the lure of the mystery of him and distant figures has always been attractive to me, because That's one reason I did my biography of Bill Belichick. And Derek Jeter was another distant figure. Coach K, maybe to a lesser degree at Duke. But I was always fascinated by Rodgers from afar. And I found him to be a great listen when he spoke publicly. I always thought he was the best interview in the NFL. Even if you didn't agree with what he was saying, I just thought he was very thoughtful and spoke. He did not speak in cliches, and he always delivered long-form answers, and he was candid. And so, but at the same time, there were a lot of people who had been around the National Football League for a long time who said they didn't really feel like they knew who he was. And so when the change in his public image really begins with COVID and a press conference in August of 2021, when he said a few words that really changed his life, up until that point, he had been considered one of the most socially aware athletes in the NFL and one of the good guys in professional football. And that really dramatically changed and has changed over the last 3 years or so. So that fascinated me as well, and how he went from one thing to almost the exact opposite, at least in the public arena. And obviously the family estrangement, the conspiracy theories, there was just a whole lot there to unpack. So that's why I took this project on.
We should say that Aaron Rodgers granted you a sit-down interview. It's the first thing you acknowledge in your acknowledgments at the end of the book. I wish we had more time to hear more about the circumstances of that conversation, but I guess I do want to ask you, how surprised were you that that he granted you that interview, and how valuable did that interview end up being in terms of helping to shape this biography?
I was surprised because I had been trying to get him to sit down with me for months, and I went through the New York Jets. I went through his agent. I directly contacted Aaron. I sent him some of my books from the past, and I was getting no response. I was just met with complete indifference. And I figured, okay, well, I guess this will be an unauthorized biography that is published without any cooperation. And I've done those books before. Bill Belichick never met with me and, in fact, called people and asked them not to talk to me. So I've dealt with that in the past. And, okay, I handed my manuscript, I believe it was late January, early February. And then a couple weeks later, I get a message from the Jets that Aaron's now willing to see me. So I was surprised. I was very happy, even though I now had to tear open the book again. So I flew out to Los Angeles, met him at his beautiful home in Malibu. We sat in his backyard. His backyard is the Pacific Ocean. It is the nicest backyard interview setting I've ever experienced. And so I didn't know how much time he was going to give me. And I thought there's a chance after 25 or 30 minutes, if he doesn't like the line of questioning, he's going to kick me out of his house. So I had to make decisions on what to ask him. I had to prioritize subjects and things I thought were most critical that I needed his input on, particularly the family situation. And so I very much appreciate the fact that here's a man who did not owe me anything. This was unauthorized. He did not ask me to write this book. I did it on my own. He had no editorial control. He was making no profit from this book. And yet he did agree to see me. And so I very much appreciate him giving me what turned out to be 2 hours. I would have loved 15 hours with him in full cooperation, but of course that didn't happen. But he made it a better book without question. And he was willing to respond on the record to some very sensitive subjects that he really hasn't talked about in the past. And that's why he made it a better book.
Right. And of course, that might touch on the reason why he was willing to do this, because you spoke to him at a time when he was being chased by quite a bit of controversy. At one point in the very opening chapter of the book, you call Aaron Rodgers a one-man, never-ending news cycle. I mean, it just seemed like with each week, Aaron Rodgers would say something else that would be outrageous or controversial or whatever. And do you think that this sit-down interview with him, he saw as a chance to kind of set the record straight in some respect?
I think, Greg, it was more he knew I had interviewed his parents at length. And his brothers did not talk to me, but his parents did at length. And he was probably concerned about that and what they said, particularly about the estrangement, which is now running up on 10 years, believe it or not. And I also think he sat down with me because I think his friends were constantly texting him for permission to talk to me. And he might have glanced at some of my previous biographies and realized that my goal was I was deadly serious about writing and painting a full and human portrait of him, the good, the bad, and everything in between, and that I had no agenda. I think he was concerned that I did, frankly. I think he saw me as another media person from New York, probably liberal, looking to really hurt him on his vaccine stances and other things. And that was my purpose, and nothing could be further from the truth. And I think once he realized I had no agenda other than getting his life story right, that's when he decided to sit with me. He saw how hard I was working on it, how many people I contacted in his life, hundreds of people. He also knew that I was writing about his grandfather's amazing combat service in World War II. And that had never been written about before, that I had found all these documents that were classified and then became declassified on every single mission that he flew in his B-24, 44 missions against the Hitler war machine. And he had no idea about his grandfather's service. He knew he served in the war, but did not have any of the details, did not know he was beaten when he was captured as a POW, was mistreated. And just some of the acts of valor in the air, some amazing things his grandfather did in saving lives. So I think that really helped as well. That was going to be chapter one always. And any chance you have as a writer to write about one of the greatest members of the greatest generation, you take it. So those things added up to Aaron deciding at the last second, okay, I'm going to give this person a hearing and let's see how it turns out.
We're speaking with Ian O'Connor about his latest book, Out of the Darkness, The Mystery of Aaron Rodgers. I was certainly going to ask you about Edward Wesley Rodgers. That would be Aaron Rodgers' grandfather. And yes, this chapter called American Hero, we hear all about his exploits in the Second World War, including his experience as a POW, a nightmare which he ultimately, of course, did survive. We don't have a lot of time. I think all I want to ask you is why you felt compelled to tell this story as you do so completely. I am really glad you do, but I'm also surprised that you do. I mean, I think a lot of people writing a biography about Aaron Rodgers might not have even mentioned his grandfather, let alone gone into such detail about this really amazing story. Is it just that it was such an amazing story, or did you see it serving a greater purpose in terms of telling the story of his grandson, Aaron Rodgers?
It's a great question, Greg, and it's almost all of the above. But I think that there's been so much negativity surrounding the family unit there that I did want to open the book with a positive story about his family legacy. And also, as a reporter, I felt like this is really 80 years later, like breaking news. No one had ever written about this. No one had ever uncovered these records. Luck is the residue of design, right? And I got lucky. I ran into a gentleman named Dan Matthews, who's a military records expert in Minnesota. And a lot of these records had been destroyed in a fire many years ago, but he found the remaining records, and I found some on my own. But he was amazing in his research and really painting the picture of all the 44 missions that Edward Rodgers flew in World War II. So I really wanted to start the book with a bit of a surprise and a signal to the reader there will be other surprises in this book, things you didn't expect to read about. But I think my admiration for the men and women who served in World War II and really saved the world, and the fact that his paternal grandfather was one of them and was he's now buried in Arlington National for a very good reason. He was a true hero and a great American. And I just think that would jolt people to read that story because they had never seen it before. And I was that is actually the my favorite chapter. It was my favorite chapter to work on and to write. And unfortunately, the family estrangement was probably my least favorite chapter to write, but it was necessary.
Of course, of course. Well, we certainly learn a lot about Aaron Rodgers' parents and about Aaron Rodgers' childhood, and beyond his impressive exploits on the football field and on the basketball court and the baseball diamond. I mean, he was successful in several different sports. We also learn a bit about what he was like in terms of interacting with other students and what kind of a student he was in terms of intellectually and so on. It's great to have so much of that story so very well told. One of the abiding themes, of course, of Aaron Rodgers is of him being underappreciated as a quarterback at almost every step along the way. I mean, he starts out small, I mean, physically small, and although he's talented, he's not recruited to any major colleges. And, of course, once he graduates from college, he is not drafted at the high position that was expected in the NFL draft. Explain what was at the heart of this perpetual underestimation of the greatness of Aaron Rodgers. Is it that he was not yet great, or was it that his greatness was somehow obscured by other matters or concerns? I mean, what was going on there that left him sort of perpetually sort of under the radar, underappreciated, and then leaving him ultimately with kind of a chip on his shoulder?
Right. His physical size is part of it. You start with that. Now he's an average-sized NFL quarterback, but he was a smaller kid. And also, major college recruiters never went north of Sacramento. And of course, he lived north of Sacramento in Chico. And so that hurt him. But he did go to a camp in high school. The University of Illinois had a camp with a lot of major college prospects at his position. And he was clearly the best quarterback at that camp. And the recruiters still did not recruit him. So his entire, here's a guy who will go down, was one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever do it. And yet his entire recruiting experience going into college was the local community college coach who happened to live about five or six houses away, walking to his front door, knocking on the door, entering the home, and convincing Aaron's mother, Darla, that her son, who scored a 1310 on the SAT, would now have to attend community college. And that was a tough sell, besides the fact that he was a great quarterback in high school. And so the coach, Craig Rigsby, who's a great character in this book, he convinces the Rodgers family, including Aaron, to go along with his plan, and that is, play for me, I will give you a platform for Division I major colleges to see you, and you will get a scholarship. And that is what happened. Cal came in, the Cal Bears, signed Aaron, and developed him, and he should have been the number one pick in the draft in 2005 for his childhood team. He dreamed of becoming the next Joe Montana and Steve Young for the 49ers, and that dream was denied. And not only did he plunge on draft day to number 24, that happened to be the first day that a video was uploaded on YouTube. That very day, YouTube was born. And it's interesting because Aaron's humiliation on national TV was the first NFL draft reality show. And so that stayed with him really to this day. And so he had that chip on his shoulder. He was always underestimated. Brett Favre did not treat him well the first couple of years in Green Bay. It got better in 2007. But when he won the Super Bowl in the winter of 2011, the 2010 season, his first agent, Mike Sullivan, told me he felt he saw a change in Aaron, that he had been misevaluated by everyone else through the early part of his career and back to high school, that he decided, I'm doing it my way now. I am the best player in the league. I am the Super Bowl MVP, and now things get done my way. So it's an interesting observation, and he's not the only one who had it, who I spoke with. But, and Aaron sort of decided on the field and off the field it was now his game to play, and that's the way he carried himself.
I appreciate the fact that you described that ordeal on draft day to the extent that you do, until, of course, that ordeal finally ends 4+ hours later when the Green Bay Packers take him. He is the 24th player chosen in that first round, much later than had been expected. One thing that I don't remember hearing about was the reaction back in Green Bay. You tell us that at the Green Bay draft party, where there were a couple of thousand fans gathered in the Lambeau Field atrium, when that announcement was made about Aaron Rodgers being their top draft choice, we're told the atrium erupted in boos. The boos of that crowd were thunderous. And it's just, it's a good thing Aaron Rodgers wasn't on hand to see that, or the humiliation of draft day would have been even deeper for him. I mean, it's really interesting and probably important for us to remember how his relationship with Green Bay Packer fans began.
Yeah, it really is. And I was not in the atrium at the time. So, of course, to recreate the scene, I spoke to a number of people who were there and felt the reverberations of the booing and the jeering. And, hey, as you know, Greg, Brett Favre was a folk hero in Wisconsin. And so now, hey, we have all these areas of need on our roster, and we don't need a quarterback. We've got one of the best ever, and he still has some years left. Why are we doing this? Why are we wasting this draft pick? And that was the reaction. And as it turned out, it was one of the best draft picks that they ever made. And most people in the draft room, particularly the coaches who were concerned, if we have a bad year, we could get fired. And we're drafting someone who will not help us this season. So Ted Thompson, others in the room who had to take the long-term and big picture and keep that in mind when making these decisions, as opposed to the coaching staff who just wanted to win next year, they made the right call. It was a tough call to make. And in some respects, it wasn't a tough call to make. He was clearly the best player on their draft board who was still available. So you don't overlook that. And it's a gift at 24 to get a player who will be a first ballot Hall of Famer at the most important position by far in the sport. So his early years, and that's certainly representative of it, were difficult, because he had to succeed a legend. The legend was not treating him neighborly in any way. And Brett Favre was very good to backup quarterbacks he did not view as a threat. He was their best friend. But as soon as there was a threat in that position, he reacted differently, like most people would, I think. But he took it to greater lengths than he probably should have. But, so that was an interesting couple of years for Aaron to get through before he was finally ready to be a starter.
Right. And I appreciate the fact that you tell us this story in such great detail. I think you're very thoughtful in the way that you tell the story of Aaron Rodgers and Brett Favre. And at what point, you write, in terms of trying to help us understand Brett Favre's attitude, Rodgers represented a clear and present danger and had to be dealt with accordingly, eliminated if necessary. The popular post-draft narrative that had the Cal quarterback learning from Favre was silly, given that Favre had no intention of teaching anything to anyone. His job was not to mentor Rodgers or to effectively expedite his own firing. Favre's job was to lead the Packers to victory and to play with a child's joy for as long as his aging body allowed. And then you go on to say, Brett Favre's mission made Rodgers' first year in Green Bay the longest year of his football life. And that's saying a lot, because Aaron Rodgers had certainly tasted a bit of frustration in his football exploits up to that time, but nothing like he experienced right off the bat with the Packers. That being said, of course, before too long, it becomes Aaron Rodgers' position as starting quarterback. And ultimately, you tell us that the relationship between Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers did improve. even maybe towards the end of Favre's time with the Packers. Explain that transformation.
Yeah, I think over time, Brett realized that Aaron, well, he understood how talented he was. But Aaron was trying to help Brett at times, taking notes on things, and when he was present for certain, whether it be workouts that weren't mandatory, that maybe Brett wasn't at, or he, if he was injured and Aaron was on the scene. And Aaron would try to pass on notes and helpful material for the starter in Brett. And I think Brett actually did come to appreciate that. And I don't think you'd necessarily want to jump too far ahead here, but let me just make a point that when the same thing effectively happened to Rodgers later in his career, I think he learned from Brett almost how not to handle it in terms of passing the baton to your successor, because he treated Jordan Love in a different way. He was, and I think Jordan Love would say today he really appreciated that Aaron did not take it out on him, that the Packers drafted his successor before Aaron was ready for them to do that. And it just took Brett Favre longer to get to that point. But I think that third year, and the people I talked to said they saw that Brett had an understanding that the Packers really needed to do that. He was aging, and he didn't have much time left as a top player in the league. And Aaron was just far too talented to pass up with the 24th pick in the draft. So, of course, today their relationship is much better than it was back then, because Aaron learned what it was like to be effectively pushed out, or at least nudged out of Green Bay after an iconic career there, because Brett went through that. Now Aaron went through what Brett did, and they shared a bond suddenly, strangely enough, all these years later, that they understood, okay. And Aaron's like, I get it now, Brett. I understand how you felt. It doesn't feel good when you're being pushed out and almost fired by a franchise that you did so much for. And so it's interesting now that they have a relationship that is maybe not, they're not best friends, but they certainly have a bond they didn't have when they were players together.
Right. And you tell us the story of how Aaron Rodgers recovered from his foot surgery. You tell us Brett Favre had to notice that his backup did not go home to heal. While using crutches and wearing a boot on his foot, Rodgers attended team meetings, watched film, and wore a headset on the sidelines to help out during games. How could an ultimate gamer like Brett Favre not appreciate that? I think you're speaking to something that probably is worth our just talking about for a second or two, which is that there are a lot of ways in which Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers are alike, but lots of ways, especially on the surface, in which they are just really different from one another in terms of personality and background and sort of the nature of their intelligence. I mean, not that Aaron Rodgers is just simply smarter than Brett Favre, but it's like they're smarter in different ways. Their intellectual lives are different, drastically different, I think it's fair to say. And it almost took a moment like this for Brett Favre and maybe for Packer fans and others to understand some of the ways in which Aaron Rodgers was just as tough, just as relentless, but in a different package than Brett Favre.
And Aaron had to show that toughness because he was following maybe the toughest player in the history of the league, an Iron Man who never sat down despite the many injuries he played through in Brett Favre, and nobody could ever take that away from him. And Aaron had no choice but to be tough, because if he wasn't, he would have been eaten alive by that Packer fan base based on what they witnessed Brett Favre going through to play every Sunday of every season that he was a Packer. So he learned about toughness from Brett Favre. He also learned how to be a playmaker, because when I talked to coaches who saw it at Cal Berkeley, Aaron was not a playmaker. He was sort of robotic in his dropbacks. He held the ball up near his ear, and Mike McCarthy had to change that and loosen him up. But he saw that Brett played with a child's joy, scrambling around, backyard football, make it up as you go, on the fly. And it was so much fun to watch. Has there ever been a more fun player to watch in the NFL than Brett Favre? And I do think Aaron learned how to be that kind of playmaker. I will say, Greg, I don't know if you agree with this, but I always felt from a distance, and I've been to some Packer games at Lambeau, but I felt that the fans always saw Brett as one of them, even though he was from the South. He was a hunter, he was a fisherman, and he would be in the bars before he got sober anyway and high-fiving fans and just really thriving by being around the people. And he was one of them. I don't think the fan base ever saw Aaron as one of them. He was not like Brett. He was an intellectual from Northern California who was a little different. He was, some people would say, an odd duck. And not really one of them, but they so respected his toughness, his talent, the Super Bowl victory, the MVPs, the greatness. I think he was a better quarterback than Brett Favre, ultimately. I would put him higher on my all-time list than Favre. Certainly more accurate, less reckless with his throws. But interestingly enough, at the end of the day, they each won one Super Bowl, and you feel like they should have won more. Bart Starr won 5 championships, and I think Packers fans expected, maybe particularly because Favre got to the second Super Bowl and Aaron didn't, that Aaron would have won more than one, because talent-wise, some people believe he's the best ever to do it. So that was a disappointment, maybe the only disappointment of his career, that there wasn't more postseason success. And as I go back and look at, as I did during my research, so much old video of Aaron playing in his prime, it's hard to believe that he didn't win a second championship ring or more at a time when Tom Brady was busy winning 7.
Right. I think you say it so well in that portion of the book right after the Packers have won that Super Bowl with Aaron Rodgers. And you write, imagine if someone told Aaron Rodgers that he would play another 11 years in Green Bay and never step foot inside the big game again. I mean, not only did he never win another Super Bowl, he never played in another Super Bowl as a Green Bay Packer. And and part of what your book does is to explore some of those reasons why. And actually, the chapter called Pain, titled Pain, is in large measure about kind of those perpetual disappointments for all the successes that ultimate success of winning another Super Bowl eluded them. One of the things you explore is the interesting relationship he had with Coach Mike McCarthy and then ultimately with Matt LaFleur, and two really different coaches. And in both cases, and ultimately what we sort of get a sense of, is that one of the problems with Aaron Rodgers was his own intelligence. And the fact that for as much responsibility as there is being quarterback, in some respects, Aaron Rodgers wanted to be even more. In fact, at one point, I think you say something to the effect that he was sort of the de facto offensive coordinator for the Packers, or at least sort of saw himself as that. Is that fair to say that maybe Aaron Rodgers' great intelligence as a football player was a beneficial gift for him, but also something that maybe created certain problems along the way?
Sure, both. And I think that his brain is his most valuable weapon. I think he would say that. He is a very smart person and football player. I think at times it frustrated the coaches because now he would go to the line of scrimmage, diagnose the defensive scheme. And he did have a menu of options to choose from that the coaches were aware of, but I think there were many times when Aaron was calling audibles that and the coaches, as they were driving down the field, had no idea what plays were being run. It was Aaron out there as the offensive coordinator running the show, and effectively. So I have to admit that if my choice in the heat of the moment in a game in the NFL is Aaron Rodgers diagnosing a defense and then calling a play versus a coach on the sideline doing it in advance of the quarterback approaching the line of scrimmage, I would go with Aaron Rodgers, I think, every time. And so, but he would also ask for certain plays to be put into the game plan during the week, and Mike McCarthy would okay them, and then those plays would not get called. There were times when Mike McCarthy would add in plays late. Aaron didn't want those plays added in. So they butted heads they had a lot of success together, and you can't take that away from McCarthy. He also, like I said earlier, developed Aaron into a franchise quarterback, loosened him up, made him more athletic, and made him a better player. He never really gets credit for that. But no question that there were times, and one example that should be mentioned is in the 2014 NFC Championship game at Seattle, which is Aaron's most devastating playoff defeat. All they have to do is recover an onside kick, and they're in the Super Bowl playing New England, a team that the Packers had defeated that year in the regular season. But they didn't recover it, and they lost in overtime. And Aaron was upset in that game because he watched film during the week of the Dallas Cowboys in the regular season beating Seattle. And he saw that the quarterback of the Cowboys, Tony Romo, ran six plays over and over that were indefensible against the Seattle defense. And he wanted McCarthy to run those six plays over and over again in that NFC Championship game. And McCarthy only ran three of them one time each. And he was, according to someone very close to the situation, very upset about that. So it got a little ugly at the end when McCarthy was fired. Aaron did want him out of there at that point in 2018. But as he told me in Malibu when I met with him, Aaron said, hey, we won a Super Bowl together, and we lit it up for a lot of years offensively, and there's no denying that.
I think one of the most interesting points in the book is actually about Mike McCarthy's successor, Matt LaFleur, and an exchange that he and Aaron Rodgers had very early on. You tell us this was one of their first conversations when the new coach told Aaron Rodgers, I just want you to turn your brain off. And then you write, a coach was telling one of the league's smartest and quickest on-field thinkers to turn his brain off. Matt, that's not how I play, Rodgers replied. I play with my mind. That's a really interesting moment, I think, because it sort of points to the fact that this is a game about more than just technique. It also is a mental game in a lot of different ways, and there are no easy answers when it comes to how to make the most of that. I mean, some players probably do think too much, and probably lots of players don't think enough. And what an interesting moment, what an interesting exchange between coach and player. I'm so glad you highlight this.
Yeah, and I'm very glad, Greg, that you asked that question and brought it up, because that was a fascinating little exchange. It wasn't so little, because I think it was profound, between those two as they were just meeting and figuring each other out. And if you want to turn Aaron Rodgers off, you tell him to turn his brain off. That's the sure way of doing it. I mean, that is the absolute worst thing to tell a guy like Aaron Rodgers. He wants his brain on around the football facility at all times. So, yeah, and I think you could see it in their most critical moment as a partnership, head coach and quarterback, third down and fourth down and goal against Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the NFC Championship game, 2020 season, when the Packers are down eight at Lambeau and it's very late in the game and they need to get a touchdown and a two-point conversion to force overtime. And on third down, Aaron famously had a chance maybe to run it into the end zone and didn't, and decided to throw on the run across his body, a very difficult throw to Davante Adams, and it was incomplete. And so now Matt LaFleur is facing fourth down and goal at the eight, and he decides to kick a field goal. And of course, as we know, the Packers never touched the ball again and lost their season. So Matt LaFleur took an awful lot of criticism for kicking that field goal. It should be noted that on three plays, the prior three plays, Aaron did not gain a single yard. So that was part of his decision-making there. But Rodgers later said that had he known that the field goal was going to be the option, he might have run a different play on third down. So it was representative of their disconnect there. They did a lot of winning together, as you know. They scored a lot of points together. Aaron won two MVPs with LaFleur. But he didn't get back to the big game. He didn't win it all like he did with McCarthy. And at the end of the day, LaFleur is the coach who was on his watch when Aaron was pushed towards the door and toward the New York Jets, and the Packers were turning it over to Jordan Love. So, frankly, today, I think Aaron has fonder memories of Mike McCarthy than he does of Matt LaFleur. But when I think of those two, Greg, I always go back to that third down and fourth down situation against Tampa Bay, and fittingly enough, Tom Brady, when there was a disconnect, and of course the Packers lost another chance to get back to the Super Bowl.
Mm. I know we're about out of time. Do you have time for two more quick questions?
Sure, Greg. Yeah,
thank you. Ahead. I appreciate it. Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Ian O'Connor about his latest book called Out of the Darkness, The Mystery of Aaron Rodgers. And I do want to say that in many respects, we're just skimming the surface. Your book is so meticulously researched and goes into such fascinating depth, including all of the years of Aaron Rodgers' greatness with the Green Bay Packers. There is a chapter called The Island. And, of course, this is a chapter that I'm sure a lot of people are talking a whole lot about. And this is the chapter that is devoted to this whole matter of estrangement. And famously, Aaron Rodgers is estranged from most of his family and has become estranged from a number of former friends and teammates and so on. And we don't need to dissect too much of the specifics. We can leave that to our listeners to explore. But I do want to give you a chance to talk about a moment when you are, at this point, talking about a rupture between Aaron Rodgers and one of his very closest friends, Jordan Russell. They were football teammates back in high school and great, great friends for many, many years. And then it kind of all went sour over a car loan. But what I want to highlight and have you talk about is what you say right after recounting that, when you say, Rodgers was never one to move past perceived slights easily. He held on to grudges like he held on to a football with a firm grip. And when somebody, when he sort of wanted to cut somebody off, the metaphor you use is, or somebody uses, is the island. They are sort of cast-offs, castaways on a distant island. And it's just sort of interesting to think about somebody operating in the world and through life with that sort of attitude. You've worked with a lot of elite athletes. Is Aaron Rodgers exceptionally like this, or is this something that we see fairly often at the higher levels of professional sports, professional athletes?
I wouldn't say I've run into many star athletes who are like that, but Derek Jeter of the New York Yankees, if he felt you had wronged him, you might be out of his life for good. Occasionally he gave a second chance, but never a third, and a lot of times never a second. So he reminded me, Aaron did, of Jeter in that regard. But, yeah, the island, it's interesting because one of Aaron's very good friends had called me the other day and was talking about the book, and he had actually read it and said he liked it, he enjoyed it. But he was talking about the island like it was a term that was used a lot. And I think Aaron's parents used that term, the island. And it's a lonely place. You don't want to be there. It's a place where there's no cell reception and there's no way to reach Aaron. And the other thing that was interesting, and I have someone quoted in the book saying this, that if you try to communicate with someone on the island, you could be the next person sentenced to the island. So really, you don't want to be there if you are interested in being Aaron's in his life. So what does that say about him as a person, as an athlete? I think what it says is he was so focused on being a master of his craft that if he felt in any way you were a hindrance to that, if you were a distraction to his focus, then you were going to the island. And you needed to be eliminated from his path. And that's how I saw it. That's how other people saw it. And he just didn't want to deal with anything that was going to fracture his focus on his one goal, and that was to be a great NFL player. And he didn't want any nonsense in his life. Now, other people may quibble with that and argue, debate whether or not his perceived slights were really slights. Family members did not believe that they had capitalized too much on his fame and success, which did bother him. That's the way he perceived it. And so you have a lot of he said, and he said, she said in this estrangement, and there are 14 or 15 different reasons why it still exists. The bottom line is it shouldn't exist anymore. Obviously, it's gone on too long, and hopefully they find peace and unity, and it happens sooner rather than later.
And maybe it's more apt to happen once he is not playing in the NFL and maybe feeling the need to be so hyper-focused on his success. A last question, and again, we leave it to our listeners to explore this in much more detail if as they read your book, and that is the fact that, of course, Aaron Rodgers, speaking of distractions, has created more distractions than any friends or family through some of the controversy he has stirred up in many of the comments that he's made, and we don't need to rehash any of that, but I'm curious, having sat down with him and explored his life, if you have managed to make sense of where some of these conspiracy theories and other kind of rather outrageous statements that he's made that seem to be at odds with so much of the rest of his persona and understanding of the world, where that comes from, what part of Aaron Rodgers's intellectual and mental life helps us make sense of that?
Well, he was always a contrarian, and he always needed to ask the question why about everything in his life. Why? He wanted to know the why of everything. And I had a friend of his tell me growing up that Aaron and this friend believed in magic and miracles. And he said to me that when you believe in that, you believe in the possibility of everything, including conspiracies. Aaron read about the and did a project on the JFK assassination in high school as a sophomore. And he was fascinated by it. He came to believe that was a conspiracy that involved a government agency. And that fed his interest in other conspiracy theories that he explored. There was a false flag operation proposal back in the 1960s from the Joint Chiefs of Staff called Operation Northwoods that Aaron studied. And Operation Northwoods was a sinister plot hatched by government officials to have the U.S. military stage an attack on a American warship and also to stage terrorist activities in American cities. So essentially, the U.S. military was planning to attack American citizens, blame it on Castro as justification to start a war with Cuba. And so it was an evil plot that President Kennedy thankfully nixed immediately. But Aaron read about that, and it did happen, at least in its concept. And he now thinks, or later on thought, that there was an Operation Northwoods behind almost every crisis in this country. And, of course, that's not true. So that's part of it as well. And I also think that he rebelled against his devoutly religious upbringing. His mother told me that everything they did when the three boys were young was built around or became a prayer project. And Aaron's no longer religious. He rebelled against that early on, and I think that rebellion planted the seeds for other rebellions to come. So there's a lot there, but I think he's a very complex character, and there's not a singular answer to your question, which is a very good one, because I've fielded that question from others. But yeah, I think when I'm asked that to me is the best way to define it, is to give that history of these multiple things coming together, and we're left with a 40-year-old man who is a conspiracy theorist. Not all conspiracies are proven false. If he embraces six or seven right now, it's quite possible one or two of them in 10 or 15 years will be proven true, but likely five or six of them will be considered crazy. So that's why he is the way he is, at least as I see it.
Mm. And one more wrinkle that makes him even more interesting. Your last line in the book, the league was a far more interesting place with Aaron Charles Rodgers in it. The book, again, is Out of the Darkness, The Mystery of Aaron Rodgers, published by Mariner Books. Ian O'Connor, congratulations on a superb book. And very best wishes in all your future writing.
Greg, it was an honor being with you, and I very much appreciate it.
Wisconsin Today and NPR News coming up. You're listening to WGTD, now with local news in the morning, four times an hour. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.